Hello and welcome to The Conduit Studio. I'm Paul Fonsale, co-founder of The Conduit, a diverse community of people passionate about positive impact. We're recording this conversation live from COP26 as part of our efforts to bring you cutting-edge content, insights, and expertise throughout the conference. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Simon Mundy. Simon is the editor of Moral Money, the Financial Times platform on socially responsible business, sustainable finance, impact investing, ESG trends, and the SDGs, and so much more. He also covers environmental and sustainability issues for the wider FT. Born in the UK, Simon began his reporting career in Johannesburg, where he covered Southern Africa for the FT before a period writing on the London financial sector. He then spent 7 years in Asia, heading the FT Bureau in Seoul and Mumbai, before 2 years traveling across 6 continents to research Race for Tomorrow, his new book about the global fight to respond to climate change. Welcome, Simon.
Thanks so much, Paul.
Awesome to have you here. I would love to hear what compelled you to write this book that distributed you across the globe.
So I had the idea in late 2017. It simply occurred to me as a reporter that this was, wow, this is the biggest story of the century. It's affecting everything. It's changing the shape of the global economy. It's changing the shape of global business and geopolitics. It's also having a profound and powerful effect on the lives of individual human beings all over the world. And I just thought, that's the big story. I also thought, I don't really know where to start with this story. There's so much information out there. There are a lot of books, but it's difficult to know which one to read. Some of the books can seem quite dense and heavy. Some of them can seem quite depressing to many people. And I just started thinking about this, and I thought maybe there would be a use to having a book which was driven by the stories of individuals who are in the thick of this, not trying to tell you what the answers are, not trying to tell you to convince you of a particular perspective, but just to say, there's a big thing happening right now all over the world. It involves some of the richest people in the world and some of the poorest people in the world. It involves people from every part of the globe and every walk of life. And these are their stories. So I started thinking about how to do it. I decided that it would need a long journey, of course, to get to these places and meet these people. I wanted to make sure that I was including people who are doing constructive things, also people who are driving problems like deforestation, people who are really prominent in the fossil fuel industry. So I started building up an approach to doing that. I started the full-time travel in mid-2019. It ended up including 26 countries altogether. Of course, the COVID pandemic broke out about halfway through my research. So from that point on, it involved a lot of quarantines and COVID tests and so on, but I managed to keep the travels going. And the book in the end, I hope, is something which the initial response suggests that a lot of people think it is, something which can be very useful for just helping you to get a handle on what is a very complicated subject, getting a handle on it through the stories of compelling people and places all over the world.
So as you know, as a journalist, what you try and do is illustrate meta themes issues of a kind of higher conceptual magnitude through the art of storytelling, and this book does this in so many different ways. But if you draw back from the aggregation of all those individual stories, tell us some of the kind of big themes you grappled with or some of the kind of interesting conclusions you began to draw as you began to see the general from the particular.
So one of them is the sense of urgency in this field. Sometimes when you listen to certain politicians, or even just in general conversation often, you would think, climate change is something, we should do something about it because this is going to be a problem in the future, or this is going to start having a real impact in the future. It's not the future, it's now. Right now, all over the world. You go and visit herders in Mongolia, as I did in the winter, they're saying our herds are being extremely badly hit by severe winter conditions driven by the changes in ice cover in the Arctic. These knock-on effects are being seen all over the world. There are people in my book, there's a great polar scientist called Konrad Steffen, one of the great climate scientists of his generation. He lost his life 4 days after we met due to an accident on the Greenland ice sheet that was directly caused by the accelerated melt of the Greenland ice sheet caused by climate change. There are, when I was in China, I met some of the leading entrepreneurs in the clean energy industry. They said, look, we want to have a positive impact. This is also where you want to be. If you want to make money in modern China, this is the sector you go into. This is where the money is being made. So all over the world in very different ways. And I should mention a really big one, which I want to single out because I think people don't talk about it enough. Al Gore has also been saying that he thinks this is the big thing that, or one of the big things people need to pay more attention to. That's climate migration. This is something I saw all over the world in many different places. People are, of course, having to move due to the impacts of climate-related weather events. Bangladesh, I saw this particularly strongly, to give just one example. People talk about the eventual flooding of Bangladesh. That is going to be a big problem. Parts of Bangladesh will end up underwater. But right now, what's happening first is the permeation of salty water over huge areas of southwestern Bangladesh where people have historically made their money through rice farming, or not even making their money, just make, subsistence farming. That's how they live. And salty water destroying the ability to grow rice. So people are moving in their hundreds and hundreds of thousands to Dhaka, the capital city. So I was in the southwest, I saw what was driving them, and then I ended up in Dhaka and I saw the conditions in which they now live. And this is just one example, a relatively early example, of the migration that we're going to see happening all over the world. It will be mainly poor people in poor countries who are migrating, but it's a problem for rich people in rich countries too. Why? What happens when you have enormous flows of desperate people trying to find new places to live? Well, that's great news if you're an extremist right-wing politician. And we can already see this starting to happen. If you look at the civil war in Syria, which drove, as you know, a very large flow of desperately people in a desperate position from this country racked by civil war, many of them headed towards Europe. Right-wing politicians used the opportunity to push politics dramatically to the right. And that war in Syria followed that country's worst drought on record. We're going to have more droughts. We're going to have more extreme weather impacts. We're going to have more people desperately trying to find new places to live. And that is going to affect all of us all over the world. So that's, there are so many examples of why this is a problem right now that we need to treat, in my opinion, with much greater urgency than we have been.
I mean, just to amplify that point a little bit, if you have climate migration causing poor people who are black and brown to go across into wealthy, largely white Europe, driving the kind of right-wing xenophobic populist politics that we've seen and that is fueled and enabled by this, those parties tend also to have pretty skeptical views on climate. And it seems to me that you then tee up a perfect storm. Climate produces the social conditions which allow parties who deny climate change and don't respond to it sufficiently urgency to thrive in the countries with the greatest emissions needing to act the most.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. The politics of climate change is something we have to deal with very seriously. There's a chapter in the book on Australia, which I managed to get to before COVID started, fortunately. I went there quite soon after the big, what was meant to be the climate election of 2019. And I met a man called Mark Butler, who was meant to be the next energy and climate minister of Australia. His Labour Party did not win the election because their pro-climate action agenda was rejected by the voters, who instead went with Scott Morrison's government, which is much more about, we need to keep the lights on. This is not, this vision of the energy sector is not safe. And we had a really interesting conversation there about how difficult it can be for a politician to drive really ambitious action. So we spoke, he instead of being the energy minister, he was the shadow energy minister, still trying to drive the national conversation in a positive direction. What's interesting to me is that it's different in different countries, of course. So even if you compare, so in Australia, Australia is in a very unique position because it is the biggest coal exporter in the world. So in Australia, you have relatively large numbers of jobs that rely directly or indirectly on the coal industry. An argument that I heard a lot there, so I went to the coal communities, I also went to, I met one of the Aboriginal leaders who was fighting against the big coal mine that's being built on his people's sacred ancestral land. So you have really powerful cultural arguments happening there. The people who are pushing for coal in Australia, none of them that I met denied the climate science. interestingly, one of them gave an argument that, look, our coal is relatively less terrible than Indonesian coal, for example. So if we mine less coal, people will just buy more Indonesian coal and burn more of it. So, and he actually said his, I think his exact words were, the number one thing that Australia can do for the climate is to mine more coal. So that's an insight into the conversation in Australia. In the UK, what's interesting to me is the extent to which it focuses on economic justice. I don't think you have many climate deniers in the UK these days, or you certainly have some who just reject the scientific consensus, but it's getting more and more difficult. Interestingly, even in the on the right wing of parliamentary politics in the UK, I don't think there are many who really question the science. What I've heard in terms of the engagement I've been doing around the book, I spoke on one quite conservative radio station, and a question was raised about how this would affect working people. Let's say the bottom 50% of the population by income distribution. And this person said, I don't remember his exact words, it was something along the lines of, people are concerned that this is an agenda that's being driven by a rich elite who are doing very well and have been doing very well in recent decades, and the costs are going to be borne primarily by the working class. And I think that concern is absolutely justified, right? Because if you look at what's been happening to income distributions in this country and the US especially over the last 30 years, the bottom 50% have basically stagnated in terms of their income. I don't like using the word bottom, but people with the 50% in terms of how the below 50% on the income distribution range, their incomes have been stagnating. The top 10% have been doing very well, and especially the top 1% and the top 0.1%. It just gets more and more extreme. So there is definitely a danger that with the energy transition, we could, if we're not careful, we have to make an energy transition. There's no question about that. But it's also an opportunity to address these other problems to do with economic justice. This is a great opportunity to address them. And if we only address the need for an energy transition without addressing these problems around income distribution, then A, it will be less effective, and B, it would be less fair, but B, it would be harder to even do it because you will have so much pushback from the general population. So I think we need to be thinking about this in the broadest possible sense and really taking into account the views of people, including people who are saying, I'm nervous about this because I don't know what it will mean to for my income. We can't just write these people off as obstructionists. We have to take their views on board.
So one of the things that your book illustrates is the interconnectedness between efforts to create a whole new generation of solar batteries or solar panels and the kind of core rare earth minerals that have to fuel them, and the trade-offs and tensions between rolling out the net zero infrastructure that is required and at the same time being faithful to human rights, thinking about working conditions and thinking about the geopolitics of how nations scramble for those resources. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I mentioned that I visited China for my research. I got there just in time. I was there in January of 2020. So pretty much one of the last foreign journalists to enter the country before the borders closed because of COVID. So while I was there, I visited several, I met several of the founders of Chinese clean tech companies. Two of the companies that I visited were in the electric car space. So as you know, China has been a powerhouse in terms of driving the growth of the electric car market. So the two companies I visited, one was XPeng Motors, one was BYD. So XPeng Motors, the founder of that company, he's not the founder, he's the current boss. He's a bit like Elon Musk. People assume he's the founder because it's got his name. In his case, it's got his name. But he actually joined it later on. So He Xiaopeng, he's the boss of XPeng Motors. It's a premium Chinese electric car company. And he was saying, you know, this is the most exciting space to be in. He was at Alibaba before, and he thought, no, I mean, Alibaba, that's great, you know, online retail, fantastic, but you know what's going to be even bigger is the clean tech industry. So it's booming, and it's only going to get bigger. But there's also the issues of the supply chains around it. So I think we absolutely need to move to zero emissions vehicles. I don't think you can seriously question that. It's now a big, powerful industry. And big, powerful industries need scrutiny. So there's a bit of a sort of unhelpful view where people think there are the people who just cheerlead for the electric car industry, and there are people who attack the electric car industry. I mean, for me, I want to scrutinize the electric car industry and provide useful information that can help it to have the best possible impact. So the other, in terms of the supply chain, to look at that, I went to Congo, DR Congo. So this is a country of 90 million people. It's about the size of Western Europe. It's got about the same length of paved roads as Wales. So this is an extremely poor place. It doesn't have to be so poor. It's got incredible resources. The reason it's poor, among other things, it was horrifically exploited by the Belgians. It was actually owned, it was King Leopold II's personal colony. It wasn't a colony of the Belgian state. It was the property of the king. It was like that. And horrific things happened. And then after that, there've been a lot of problems with governance in Congo. The resources not being used for the benefit of the people. That's the fault of various corrupt Congolese politicians and their foreign partners. Foreigners have been a key part of the corruption, of course, that continues in Africa and continues to undermine the health and livelihoods of its people. So in Congo, I wanted to look at the cobalt mining. There's over 100,000 what they call artisanal miners in Congo. It's a bit of a euphemism, artisanal. It's completely informal. The place that I went to is in a town called Kolwezi in the southeastern Congo. And there's an area of Kolwezi called Kasulo. So one day about 10 years ago, more or less, a man was digging a latrine behind his home in Kasulo, and he hit upon this black seam of cobalt. And he knew what it was because a lot of people are miners around there. Everyone recognizes cobalt. So he didn't keep digging that hole. He went inside his house and started digging a pit inside his house. He didn't want anyone to know that he'd found this treasure. So he actually he dug a shaft inside his house, and he would take the sacks of cobalt out under cover of darkness, and he would sell them to merchants on the edge of town. Eventually, his secret got out, and then everyone in Kasulo started mining around their houses. Completely dangerous, of course. Children could be falling into it. It was dangerous for the integrity of the buildings themselves, of course. So when I got there, there is still, so part of Kasulo has now been sort of sectioned off by the government and handed over to a Chinese mining company. But there's still plenty. So I was walking through the streets of Kasulo and I just saw a mine shaft. There were several mine shafts on a single property. The property itself was owned by a man called Papa Jean. Papa Jean is about 90 years old, and he's just enjoying the fun. You know, he gets a cut of the money from the mining. But all around his property, there are, I think it was 5 mine shafts, each run by a different sort of micro tycoon who would use their savings to fund the miners who would go down there, and they would be digging up the cobalt and making money. So the micro tycoon that I befriended was called Monique. She's in her 40s. She used to run a women's clothing boutique in Lubumbashi. She got divorced from her husband, had to leave Lubumbashi. So now she's starting out again as a mining micro tycoon. So people like Monique, it's complicated, right? And I went inside one of her shafts. Probably shouldn't have done that. It was quite scary just to get down there, because it's very deep and you have to go down barefoot, sort of like a chimney sweep sort of thing.
Wow.
And then when you're down there, of course, they collapse from time to time. They're dying all the time because there's no proper structure. It's not like a mechanized mine where you have proper structures in place for safety. But there are people who are down there every day. I was down there for 15 minutes and that felt like a lot. There are guys who get down there for 10 hours a day, every day. And hopefully they're still alive at the end of 20 years doing that. And there have also been children going down there. I met a young man called Celestin, who was 13 when he started going down into one of these informal shafts. So what do we do about this, right? Because some people are saying, let's just not buy any more cobalt from Congo. Most of the world's cobalt is in Congo, most of the world's reserves, most of the world's production. But there are other places that have it. Australia has some cobalt. Maybe we should just cut off Congo from the global economy and just get our cobalt somewhere else. That's the easy thing to do if you're a big car maker. Then you don't have the activist on your back. And then you have a lot of focus on child labour. The activists are attacking companies for allowing child labour potentially into their supply chain. And I think we should absolutely be very angry about child labour and try to prohibit it and stop it at every opportunity. But if you stopped Celestin from going down a mine, he'd probably have been begging. You know, the reason he wasn't going down a mine because someone forced him to, he was going down a mine because he didn't have any money. And public education by law is free in the Congo, but in practice it's not. And why is that? It's because of these deeper structural problems that are much harder to fix than simply saying, oh, we'll put in a process to make sure we don't have any children in the mine. Well, that's a good start. But how do you make sure those children are in school? How do you make sure that the government is actually putting the money into the budget to pay for the schools? That's a much tougher question to ask. But we need to be engaging with those questions.
It strikes me it also, we're here at COP. There's been a decades-long broken promise to do a transfer from wealthy nations to developed nations based on a kind of notion of climate justice that everybody in theory, buys into, that rich nations got rich by both exploiting the poor, as you've the King Leopold story, exploiting the, through colonialism. And they also got rich by not counting their carbon. And now, as the new green economy takes off and as DR Congo has an opportunity to ride that wave of wealth creation, it is prohibited to doing so because the nature of the way that mining is structured and organized means that you have deep qualms about child labor and other forms of the way in which the extraction happens. So it seems that we've got to solve that, because to leave that cobalt in the ground would be terrible. We won't get to net zero without it. To extract it using children is a problem. But who on the ground is actually solving that devilish problem through finance, through standards, through structures, through modern mining techniques, net zero mining techniques, dare I add? Those are the tougher questions, right?
Yeah, and I think I'm so glad that you use that word, that expression, the tough questions, because honestly, so we've both been here at COP26 in Glasgow, and we've been listening to a lot of perspectives from different people. I don't know about you, personally, it seems to me that some people are talking as though the answers are easy, as though we're sort of on track. We're really badly off track, obviously, and B, this is hard. You know, when I hear a company claiming to be sustainable, I just sort of think, in fact, this is a bit off track, but I think it's relevant. Patagonia, the clothing company, known for making a real effort to be more sustainable. Patagonia recently said, we are not sustainable. We are part of the problem, and we are trying to do better. And that was the sort of messaging that, to be honest, it contrasts with some of the messaging I've heard from some other much bigger companies, including some things I've heard at COP, where people are basically saying, oh, we're sustainable, we've done that. It's really hard. And I don't have the answers, obviously. I don't think any individual has all the answers. But I think we need to start from the recognition. Well, two things, really. One, that it's really, really hard, but also that there is so much we can do. We can be so much more ambitious. We talk about carbon markets, for example. We need to update the economic system to put a price on carbon. Why? Because, as you say, the big companies and the individual consumers, you and I, by global standard, I mean, I'm assuming you live in a modern flat and you use various things that are part of being a person living in modern London. Therefore, you have a huge carbon footprint, as I do, by global standards. And so... to address that, we need to change the incentives, because realistically, everything that we use in modern London has a fairly big carbon footprint, because that's the economic system that we live in. So if you want to live a modern life in London, you don't really have a choice. But so that's why I get uncomfortable when people focus on, oh, I'm trying to minimise my personal carbon footprint. I think that's good, but that can't be the main focus, because you're quite limited to what you can do on that front as long as you live within a high carbon economy. And to do that, we need to start putting a price on carbon, and that is difficult. But I think we need to wrestle with it. So the first thing is that it's hard. The second thing is there's a lot we can do, and we can be way more ambitious, in my opinion, than we are being.
Obviously, as the editor, and I kind of ask you this by way of conclusion, you edit the Moral Money column in the Financial Times. It's one of the most widely read opinion shaping and information conveying columns, and read by activists, entrepreneurs, policymakers, CEOs, etc. And one of the things that's emerged for me out of this COP, and I'd love you to reflect on it, is business is here in much more present way than it previously has been, partly because of activist investment, partly because of youth activists on the street, partly because of the own consciousness raising of people on the boards whose children are saying, you know, mum or dad, you know, what did you do and you're leaving us behind. And I have a sense that it is unavoidable now. Climate has risen from a nice to have to the heart of corporate decision making. Chief sustainability officers sit on boards, report to the CEOs. And there's always this balance between innovation and conviction and greenwashing. And I wonder from where you sit how you're going to referee, you know, that phenomenon, which I think is going to be, you know, for the next couple of years, a big thing to referee.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't personally think of myself as a referee, I think, but absolutely to be scrutinizing what's happening. Yeah, like I said, anything that's being done by big, powerful companies or anyone in a position of influence needs to be scrutinized. And it's not about throwing stones at anyone. It's simply saying, this is an opportunity to point out ways that things can be done better. I mean, that's the point of journalism, the core point of journalism for me. You know, that you have journalism that's entertainment, but I think, you know, the rest of it is providing a useful tool to people who are trying to figure out how to do things better. So that's the approach I take to it. And there's so much room for all of us to do things better. I need to do my job better. And I think anyone who's involved in the sustainability space needs to have that approach because we're so far off track. We can't all be doing our jobs well enough, otherwise we'd be on track, right? But I would include myself in that for sure. And that's why we always say in Morrow Money, let us know your thoughts. Let us know what you think. We read every single one of those responses that we get. And we take them on board because we don't know everything. In terms of the business presence at COP, it's complicated. I think, as you say, it's gone from being at the margins to being very core to corporate strategy. I mean, I remember, so I started as a business journalist in 2009. And back then, you look at a company's annual report and the stuff about the environment would be on sort of page 273 or something and just sort of, you know, there just because it has to be there. Now it's in the chairman's letter at the very front. And its core, and they are actually under a lot of questions from their investors, also from their customers, also from their young employees, increasingly. And as you mentioned, from children at home. You'd be amazed how many business people, business leaders that I meet who would say, yeah, you know, my daughter is on my back about this stuff. It's always a daughter and never a son, by the way. And that's something that we need to think about. Why is it that young women are so much more engaged than young men? Why are young men not more engaged in this? That's a separate thing. But that's definitely having an impact on their thinking. They're human beings as well. And if you're a CEO with a youngish daughter, probably you're going to be having some uncomfortable conversations with her. And probably if you have a youngish son as well. So that's part of it. In terms of the presence at COP, though, I'm sort of in two minds about it. Because on the one hand, it's a powerful reflection of the increased seriousness with which business are approaching this area. I spoke to someone who's the head of a very influential group that deals with climate stuff, and he said that, and he's been going to all the COPs for years, and he said that he's met more CEOs at this COP in the last, we've met only 10 days into the COP or less, I think maybe a week into it. And he said he's met more CEOs at this COP than he's met at all the other COPs combined. So this is different this time. This is very, very different in terms of the business presence on the ground. So that's good in a way. Now, the other thing, as you know, people have been finding it very hard to find a place to stay in Glasgow. There are people, I mean, I was speaking to someone from who's part of the national delegation from a fairly prosperous country who was staying in Edinburgh because this person couldn't find a way to stay in Glasgow. So if that's a prosperous country, then there's a lot of people from the national delegations, also from, you know, civil society, all sorts of groups who are really engaged in this stuff, who can't afford to stay in Glasgow. Who can, because the prices have been getting huge. You know, there are 2-star hotel rooms going for over £1,000 a night. Who can afford that? If you're from a really big company, it's fine, you know, £20,000 for a few nights accommodation. Yeah, it's fine. You know, so there's a real disparity. So overwhelmingly, the accommodation in Glasgow is certainly big business is overrepresented. And the issue there is you have the core government intergovernmental negotiations, but then around that you have thousands and thousands of other people who are here taking part in the wider conversation that influences in a powerful way the negotiations happening within that room. So you have a massive overrepresentation of big business people. Well, who is almost absent? I'll tell you who's almost absent. Most people in the world earn a few thousand dollars a year or less. There are very few people within that income range, which accounts for most human beings on the planet, billions of people like that. There are very few people here, because you have people from developing countries, and it's fantastic that they're there, by the way, that they're here, because we wouldn't, you know, it'd be awful if we had no one from developing countries. But they tend to be the more prosperous people from developing countries. I think they're doing the best job they can of representing the interests of those people who are on very low incomes. But if you're on the ground, you really have a much more powerful opportunity to influence the conversation. I would hope, this is perfectly possible, if the UN sets up a program saying, we want to set up a UN program that will enable, for all future COPs, there'll be people on the ground alongside their elected representatives who have come from the most vulnerable communities and other communities, just to make sure that there is that representation on the ground of people who can speak with their own voices. Because if you're a big business person, you probably spend a lot of time talking to other big business people. Many politicians also spend a lot of time with other powerful people. But when you've spoken, as I have, of course, for the book research, I've met a lot of people and spent time with them, slept in their homes in some cases, who are really suffering extremely severely. And when you've actually met people like that in person, not just read about them, you've actually met them, it has a pretty powerful impact. So I would hope that's something we could address at future COPs.
I think bringing the voice of ordinary people both to COP, but also to a broader set of readers through your book is something that you have done exceptionally well. I'm enormously grateful for your time. I commend the book to anybody who hasn't got it or read it. We'll put up some notes about it in the show notes. And Simon Mundy, thanks for your time.
Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for tuning into this conversation. And don't forget to keep an eye on the Conduit social channels for upcoming content from COP26. For more information on the Conduit and our community of changemakers, please visit theconduit.com.